With his focus on the bridge to the 21st century, President Clinton delivers his second inaugural address on January 20th, 1997.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, William Jefferson Clinton.
My fellow citizens, at this last presidential inauguration of the 20th century, let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century in a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs, a moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young. Guided by the ancient vision of a promised land, let us set our sights upon a land of new promise. The promise of America was born in the 18th century out of the bold conviction that we are all created equal. It was extended and preserved in the 19th century when our nation spread across the continent, saved the Union, and abolished the awful scourge of slavery. Then, in turmoil and triumph, that promise exploded onto the world stage to make this the American century. And what a century it has been. America became the world's mightiest industrial power, saved the world from tyranny in two world wars and a long Cold War, and time and again reached out across the globe to millions who, like us, long for the blessings of liberty. Along the way, Americans produced the great middle class and security in old age, built unrivaled centers of learning and open public schools to all, split the atom and explored the heavens, invented the computer and the microchip, and deepened the wellspring of justice by making a revolution in civil rights for African Americans and all minorities, and extending the circle of citizenship, opportunity, and dignity to women. Now, for the third time, a new century is upon us, and another time to choose. We began the 19th century with a choice to spread our nation from coast to coast. We began the 20th century with a choice to harness the Industrial Revolution to our values of free enterprise, conservation, and human decency. Those choices made all the difference. At the dawn of the 21st century, a free people must now choose to shape the forces of the information age and the global society, to unleash the limitless potential of all our people, and yes, to form a more perfect union. Thirty-four years ago, the man whose life we celebrate today spoke to us down there at the other end of this mall in words that move the conscience of a nation. Like a prophet of old, he told of his dream that one day America would rise up and treat all its citizens as equals before the law and in the heart. Martin Luther King's dream was the American dream. His quest is our quest, the ceaseless striving to live out our true creed. Our history has been built on such dreams and labors. And by our dreams and labors, we will redeem the promise of America in the 21st century. To that effort, I pledge all my strength and every power of my office. I ask the members of Congress here to join in that pledge. The American people return to office a president of one party and a Congress of another. Surely they did not do this to advance the politics of petty bickering and extreme partisanship they plainly deplore. No. They call all us instead to be repairers of the breach and to move on with America's mission. America demands and deserves big things from us, and nothing big ever came from being small. And so, my fellow Americans, we must be strong, for there is much to dare. The demands of our time are great, and they are different. Let us meet them with faith and courage, with patience and a grateful, happy heart. Let us shape the hope of this day into the noblest chapter in our history. Yes, let us build our bridge. A bridge wide enough and strong enough for every American to cross over to a blessed land of new promise. May those generations whose faces we cannot yet see, whose names we may never know, say of us here that we led our beloved land into a new century with the American dream alive for all her children, with the American promise of a more perfect union, a reality for all her people, with America's bright flame of freedom spreading throughout all the world. From the height of this place and the summit of this century, let us go forth. May God strengthen our hands for the good work ahead, and always, always bless our America.
Hello, and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and coming up next, Scott Horton interviews Robert A. Pape and Adam Lankford, the two professors who are also authors, debate the root causes of suicide terrorism and whether it results from U.S. foreign policies and military occupations, or is it instead a manifestation of a personal mental health issues.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And our next guests are Adam Lankford and Robert A. Pape. Robert A. Pape, many of you are familiar with. He's been on the show numerous times in the past. He's the author of the books Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and Cutting the Fuse, The Explosion of Global Suicide Terrorism, and How to Stop It. And you'll often hear him cited by Ron Paul in his presidential campaign when he talks about how we got into this mess with the war on terrorism. And Dr. Adam Lankford is a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama. From 2003 to 2008, he helped coordinate senior executive anti-terrorism forums for high-ranking foreign military and security personnel in conjunction with the U.S. State Department's Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program. And he has a recent piece at the Huffington Post called Ron Paul is Wrong About 9/11 Studies Show. Welcome both of you to the program. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Good to be here.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you both joining us very much on the show here. So I guess real quick, Adam, we'll start with you. If you could please explain your studies, and was it something specific or many different points that Paul made that he was wrong about? Make your case from your article, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Well, I guess I would say overall, you know, believe it or not, I don't have a strong political agenda here. I keep my nose in the books, and I'm so busy studying behavior that kind of politics takes a back seat for me. What I'm talking about what Representative Ron Paul got wrong is this idea that foreign occupation directly causes suicide terrorism and that foreign occupation caused 9/11. I don't disagree that, you know, foreign occupation and that wars overseas can be bad and that bad policies are obviously bad. But just because they're bad, that doesn't mean they caused suicide terrorism or they caused 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And you also specifically mentioned Dr. Pape's books in your article and actually criticized the method of his research as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Dr. Pape's been working on studying suicide terrorism for a long time, and I certainly appreciate his efforts, but the bottom line is, you know, I think he's coming to the wrong conclusions, particularly when it comes to foreign occupation. You know, it's hard for me to imagine kind of a more explicitly biased opinion than this kind of simplistic idea that, the U.S. is to blame for bringing kind of 9/11 on itself and that U.S. policy is to blame for suicide terrorism. The reality is that suicide terrorists don't operate because of political motives or because of other ideological motives or because of religion. It's really more about the personal problems in their lives, which then lead them to decide that they want to kill and be killed. And there are certainly a lot of specific problems I have with the conclusions Dr. Pape makes, but I'm not sure we want to get into that level of depth.
Well, we have some time. Bob, let's go to you now. It's certainly, from my point of view, social science is social science. It's not really science. And even with science, if you ask the wrong question, a lot of times you can get a misleading answer. And I wonder what you think of the criticism that maybe you're asking the wrong question here, and that's what's leading you to see occupation as the root. Rather than
right. I'm definitely glad to get into the details here, Scott. So I think, Adam, we should definitely come back. Let's get into the details, because that's what Adam wants to do, and I'm definitely glad to do that. Been doing this for 10 years, 24/7, so I have no problem doing that. But so far, Adam's basic charge is I came to this with a preconceived notion. I hate America, and I think it's occupation that must be driving this, and this is just poppycock. In the 1990s, I taught for the U.S. Air Force. If you go back and look at my history, you'll see that I spend a lot of time over the last 30 years not criticizing America because I hate it, but trying to help us pursue better policies that get things right. That's what's been happening in my career pretty much since it began in the 1980s. I think that's why a lot of folks in Washington have not just generally paid attention. So this isn't just about Ron Paul, but much of my research has been funded by the Department of Defense, been funded by the Department of Defense many times, supported by the intelligence community, and not just by, say, the Obama, not just Johnny Come Latelys, but in fact, starting in 2004. Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Department was one of the biggest funders of the work that we're now discussing. And they're not doing it because they think that this is, let's just blame America and for some political advantage. They really are doing it because there are people, believe it or not, in Washington and around the country who sincerely just want to get things right. And now, where did I come from this argument? Well, in the 1990s, as you just heard, I was studying air power. I wasn't studying terrorism. I did start to study terrorism after 9/11. And actually, like a lot of people, I initially thought it was Islamic fundamentalism. And so what I thought I was going to do was start to collect the detailed biographies of individuals to find the point where these religious extremists would transform and then become violent terrorists, so violent they would want to kill themselves. Pretty much the spectrum of radicalization that in some ways Adam supports and many have supported for many, many years. That's where I started from. But as I got into the details and as I got deep into the details of not just individual attackers, which I did many, many times, collecting then the universe, which became the first complete universe of all suicide attacks around the world, then something completely different jumped out at me. And that was, foreign occupation, especially by democracies. This came from the data itself. This was also not something that as soon as I saw it, I immediately went and rushed to the press. I spent 2 years with a research team in 2002 and 2003 verifying the data in detail, even before the first versions were published. And then once I got funding from the Defense Department and other sources, I was able to get an even larger research team to collect not just information in English, but in all the key native languages associated with the phenomenon, Arabic, Hebrew, Tamil, Russian. We sent people to Cairo, Beirut, Damascus, basically to collect information on black markets, such as martyr videos. We probably have the largest martyr video collection in the world at this point. And much of these detailed documents, by the way, are available on our web post, our website at CPOS. That's
all right, now, Bob, I'm going to have to hold you there because there's so much to go over already.
Sorry, Scott. There's just a whole lot underneath this idea that somehow I came at this with some preconceived
I hate
America. This is just totally poppycock.
Okay, now, Adam, is it possible that someone like Michael Scheuer or someone like Ron Paul or someone like Robert A. Pape or even myself could have different reasons for concluding that our foreign policy tends to provoke terrorist acts against us and still be America-loving patriots with all the best intentions at the very same time, or not?
Sure.
Are we blaming the rape victim here, as you put it in your article, really?
Well, what I would say is, it's certainly fair to make a distinction between Dr. Pape, and I'm glad to hear, that he has no agenda, and that, people who cite his research could certainly have a big agenda, and frankly, their agenda could be to save lives and do the best thing for this country. So, again, I'm not really against this idea that we should stop bad policies or stop bad wars. I'm certainly in favor of that. I guess a couple of things when we get into the details. Dr. Pape says a lot of things which sound impressive, about being funded by the government. And, of course, the government wants answers, just like we all do, about how he has the universe of attackers. But really, it's not how many attackers or how many attacks you can put into a database. It's how well you understand them in depth that matters. In one of his previous books, Dying to Win, that came out in 2005, I believe, he claimed to have performed the most, I believe the quote was, comprehensive and reliable study at the time of something like 462 it was at that point, 462 suicide attackers. And his conclusion based on his research team, which, I might not be fair to say, but it seems to me, sounds like it's some graduate students collecting data. His conclusion was that based on looking at the lives of those 462, that not a single one was depressed, not a single one was had been dealing with adultery, not a single one was homosexual, not a single one was struggling with any sort of significant shame. That's just not credible. That's not credible. That's not what people who study and understand other human beings say. You can't go into a room on the face of the earth and find 462 people and not find one who's depressed, except Dr. Pape, based on his method, somehow managed to do that with suicide terrorists.
Dr. Pape?
Scott, I think it's just not reading Chapter 10, Chapters 9 and 10 of Dying to Win closely enough. I never claimed not a single one was depressed. Just not the case. In fact, I even take into account a lot of the missing data. The bottom line is that the argument that that Adam seems to want to support is that mental illness is what's driving suicide terrorism, that suicide terrorists kill themselves because they're suicidal, not because they're angry at occupation policies. And that is an argument that has been around for 20-some years. It was first put forward by Ariel Mirari, an Israeli scholar, and has been widely discredited. I do report similar reasons why others have discredited the argument, but the bottom lines are this, which is folks such as me who have looked in detail at the biographies of the suicide attackers that we can look at typically find about 3 to 5% seem to have serious signs of what you would call depression, serious signs that would show up in by clinical psychiatrists as counting for depression for ordinary suicide. And I say that not simply because I've counted these up, but in 2004, I was part of meetings with the Department of Homeland Security with Murari himself, where the FBI's clinical psychiatrists and forensic psychiatrists, which the FBI actually has, real professionals, basically grilled Murari and destroyed his arguments right in front of everybody, including people from Israel, that is Israel's Homeland Department of Homeland Security, essentially pointing out that the indicators he's using of mood swings, broken homes, distance from family, that are simply soft indicators that would fit about 50% of all American adolescents or people in their 20s at some point in their lives, and not the kind of harder indicators that clinical psychologists would point to, such as persistent, recurring suicidal thoughts independent of circumstance. That is not simply as a function of, say, living under an occupation. That is weeks alone in self-isolation or multiple bouts of crying spontaneously where the crying goes on for hours on end. I'm not seeing any of those show up in Adam's work. Now, maybe they do. They seem to show up, again, about 3 or 4% of the cases, as I report in Dying to Win, and as others, like Mark Sageman, have reported as well. The softer indicators are just simply too present, and they're present in virtually every group of adolescents all around the world. And so if they really were driving at these soft indicators, we would just see fantastic numbers of suicide attackers pretty much everywhere from pretty much every type of society. Anyway, for those long sets of reasons, I and many others have simply long discounted mental illness of depression that would lead to ordinary suicide, leading to suicide terrorism.
Well, on the other hand, you have a lot of occupied people and very few who actually participate in suicide attacks. So what does make those individuals special?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Scott. There's far more people who are living in occupied lands than living in occupied lands and are suicidal and are exploited by terrorist organizations. It's about being precise and narrowing the net. Explanations like foreign occupation, that just doesn't hold.
Adam, you need to go and read Chapter 6 of Dying to Win. So I spent about 100 pages in Dying to Win, the first book. So Dying to Win is not just an op-ed piece that's kind of extended here. There's a 100-page analysis to answer the question, why some occupations and not others? And actually, Scott's allowed me to talk about this at some length in some of his previous shows, because it is very, very important. But basically, what I did is I looked at, I'm showing that about 95% of all suicide attacks are in response to occupations by democracies. And you're saying, well, there are many, many of these. Well, that's true. And in fact, some political scientists have done some counting work for me. There's a Polity data set that actually counts approximately 59 occupations by democracies in the 1980s and 1990s. So what I did is I did analysis of those to try to figure out what was it about the nine that led to the suicide terrorism. And there are two specific factors which jump out. Number one is prior rebellion. Suicide terrorism is a strategy that's adopted by groups in rebellion to a occupation, but typically only after a prior rebellion has not only broken out, that is a prior ordinary rebellion with no suicide attack, but it's not only broken out, but also failed to end the occupation. So issue number one is prior rebellion. We would not be too surprised once we understand that suicide terrorism is a strategy of last resort, and that's what the data shows. Issue number two is when there is an occupation that also has a religious difference, that is, where there's a different religion predominantly in the occupier society and predominantly in the occupied society. And when that religious difference occurs, it's not that some religions are more prone to do this than others. It's that when there's a religious difference, the terrorist leader is able to paint the occupier as the religious aggressor, essentially scaring the bejesus out of the local community.
This little song that I'm singing about, people you know it's true. If you black and got to work for a living now, this is
is what they would say to you. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh, brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night. They was all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh, brother, get back, get back, get back. They went to employ me at office. The number that I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh, brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man was working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him a dollar an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh, brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now I guess that you can see what a black man have to do. He says, if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh, brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hole. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you're gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But if you black, oh, brother,
yeah. You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.